I'd like to convene the House Judiciary Committee at 107 on Thursday, March 28th, 2001. For the record, present are Representatives Berkowitz, Meyer, Coghill, Roachberg, and Ogun. We do have a quorum to do business. On today's calendar, we have HB 52 Compact for Adult Offender Supervision, HB 40 Revoked Driver's License for Fatal Accident, and HB 4 Omnibus Drunk Driving Amendment. With that, I'd like to very quickly take up HB 52, and Ms. Brower, could you come forward in just a moment and give us about a 30-second jog our memory and what this bill does?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, for the record, my name is Candace Brower, and I'm the legislative liaison for the Department of Corrections. House Bill 52 is an act relating to Interstate Compact for Adult Offender Supervision. And basically what this is it's proposing a new compact to replace the 1937 enactment of the Interstate Compact. It is to promote more offender accountability and better record keeping and keeping track of offenders across state lines. This is a an agreement between states that adopt this, and what we're hoping this will provide will be better supervision of offenders and better protection of victims and the community.
Very good. Just for the information of the audience, we've had a full hearing on this legislation previously, and we have to act to move it on its way. Any questions, Mr. Bowers? Seeing none, Representative Logan.
Nancy, if you could refresh my memory, there's a portion in here I know I had some heartburn with, and it had to deal with the fact that Compact actually can make a law or make a bylaw that has the effect of law in that particular state.
Right.
Point out that section of the bill to me. I can't find it right away.
Well, it's a large bill, and I don't have it memorized either, so bear with me. I believe Article 7, perhaps. Article 7 talks about the rulemaking functions of the commission.
May we just talk about that concept?
Sure.
A little bit. So the rule, the commission. This is a national commission, correct? Representatives appointed from
each state,
and that national commission can actually have the effect of force of law in other states that are members of this compact?
That's correct.
That's what I thought. I'm going to object to the bill and not recommend it be passed, because I feel it's an undermining of our sovereign powers as a state, because I guess I have a little bit of a problem with somebody, an organization that isn't defined in our Constitution, our state's Constitution, that has the ability of essentially making a law in our state, or something has the force of law in our state. I think it's a violation of the 10th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution.
Well, if it were in opposition to our Constitution, if there was a rule that this commission made that was in opposition to our Constitution, then we would not have to follow that.
Can I follow up with that?
Hurry up.
What is, Mr. Chairman, this is important, I won't be rushed. What is the process for that law? It has to be litigated to be proved unconstitutional. Is that correct?
I don't know that it has to be litigated, no.
Well, if I might, who's going to put their their legal holy water on it to say that it's unconstitutional. Is there, what's the review process for that?
Well, there's a body that oversees the compact, and that's a body that's hired by the commission to oversee the compact, and they would be arbiters in disputes and problems that arise out of the states having disagreements or the state having a problem with the compact. If enough states had a problem with a particular rule, they could overturn that rule. If it's unconstitutional, we could argue that it's unconstitutional. And if we had a problem with the compact, we could repeal it.
Well, I guess my big problem with the compact, and I'll end here, is that we're taking away what I consider to be a legislative power, and we're delegating it to a national compact that's going to have lawmaking authority in our state that's outside of the rules of our Constitution, and I object to that strenuously.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Coghill and Bergwitz.
So, Candace, I actually agree with Representative Ogun. But I think the safeguards are already in there, and in my reading of the bill. So maybe the question should be put to you that would this compact cause us to violate any of our existing laws?
I don't believe so. And if we have a representative available during the process of creating the bylaws, we would have representation to make sure that that didn't happen.
Mr. Chairman, to follow up, then anything that did cause us tension against our own laws, would it come before this body?
This body would receive a report from the compact, and I'm sure it would come before this
but
body.
Not necessarily.
There will be representation from the legislation.
And I think the concern to me is that it could overrule this body as far as its legislative powers, and that's where I agree with Representative Ogun, that if it could make policy that would change our law before we had a chance
to review. It wouldn't change our law, but we would be forced to comply with the compact, with the contractor agreement. And if there was a problem with that, there are ways that we can deal with that, and part of that is through the compact.
Mm-hmm. Representative Bergwitz.
Mr. Chair, are you ready for a motion?
Yes, I am.
I'd like to move that we move from committee House Bill 52, not amended, I understand, with attached fiscal note.
Which has been lowered, incidentally. We have a new fiscal note.
Object.
Representative Ogun, do you want to comment on your objection?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think we tread in very dangerous water as a legislature when we delegate lawmaking powers to a national organization that's a compact and give them the power to have the force of law in our state. Our Constitution is pretty clear. I doubt very seriously if they take an oath to defend the Constitution of our state. I know I do. And there's a clearly defined process for laws that are defined in our state and that's laid out in the Constitution. And I think the intent of the legislation is good and honorable, and it's all well-meaning. But I think in principle that the more powers that we delegate to somebody else of this state, the more we're on a slippery slope to a tyranny. And I object to this in principle of this bill in the strongest fashion that I can. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, let's speak very briefly. This is a contract. If the Constitution is so weak that it can't uphold the state's rights in any contractual negotiation, and we oughtn't be a state at all, I think the Constitution is strong enough to safeguard our liberties. These fears of tyranny, I think it's less of treading in deep water than wading in a shallow pond. And I, again, reiterate my motion that we move.
I'd just like to comment that I believe that the United States Constitution and our Constitution, I know the U.S. Constitution explicitly calls out for the right of states to enter into compacts, and that's what we are doing here. We're following constitutional law, very specifically, that's expressed, not even implied. Now, whereas I can appreciate the Representative Ogun's concern on a philosophical basis about granting our legislative and constitutional powers to a body via contract, I believe that Ms. Brower makes an excellent point that representation in the formation of those, that rulemaking process, is a safeguard to that and one we should participate in rather than do it later and then not have that input and make sure that when the rulemaking process took place, we did not have input. I don't agree with the argument on the fundamental constitutional and philosophical rights. I do agree with Representative Hogan, though, that we need to safeguard our rights and protect our state. The need for this legislation in order for us to participate in interstate trafficking of parole prisoners and the supervision of those adult offenders is I think, overwhelming. So I'm going to support this legislation. Representative James.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize for being late. I just can't seem to get good at doing one thing before I have to be someplace else. So,
we all understand that. And, we'll do it again.
Has this entire bill been discussed since before, or is it just discussed today since
No, we had a full hearing on this legislation.
Okay, because I must have missed that one, too. Anyway, I apologize for that. But having said all that, one of the things that, yes, we can enter into contracts. This sounds to me like a long-term one that's going to be forever. If I'm incorrect, I'd like to have somebody to tell me about that. And the interest that I have is not so much as, and I don't know how many states, somebody could tell me too, how many states are in this. Are they all in it?
To be ratified, there have to be 35 states.
There's an existing one.
That means
one.
That there are.
There's an existing one that's existed since the 30s.
37.
Okay. 37.
There have to be 35 states to do this. That scares me. That really scares me. And why it is because that means that out of 50 states, there's 15 states that don't want it. And so then it's not, then it's still effective. And they're going to be affected one way or the other, whether they're a part of it or whether they aren't. Does that mean that if they disagree, they're going to be a part of it anyway?
No.
That's the one they'll come.
Let the record show that Representative James and Kukesh are here also. And thanks to the 4-H's for coming.
Thank you.
Question.
Question: could the secretary read? Did you have an answer? Were you looking for an answer, Representative James? Or?
Well, I didn't. No, I don't need it.
Okay. Could the secretary read the roll?
Mr. Chairman,
Representative,
briefly wrap up. Mr. Chairman, I guess I just want to reiterate. I think it's another chip away at the 10th Amendment to contract our way our legislative powers. It might be legal and constitutional, but I suppose it's legal and constitutional for our troops to be under our UN troops to be under command of a foreign officer. But I think it's a bad policy call. I kind of consider this the same kind of thing. We're given this compact ability to make laws in our state, and that's. We want to do that, but as long as we do it, knowing what we're doing.
If the people are comfortable with us making laws, they ought to be comfortable with this organization.
Well, I'm not sorry. I don't necessarily agree with that, Representative Burgley. I think we clearly have the constitutional right and authority and responsibility to do Danner in this compact. But Representative James.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. But, you know, the comment that was previously made by Representative Berkowitz, it's because of the way things happen here that I don't want it to happen there when we don't have the opportunity to speak. And the whole issue of the general public does not buy into what that we do. We don't know what the consequences even of our action as we sit at this table are going to be until we implement it and then we hear from the people who are adversely affected. So, you know, to say that we want to give up that right, to me is a little distressing. So I'm not going to say what I might do when this gets all down the road a little bit, but I'm going to object to moving it out today.
All right.
The Secretary read the roll, please.
Representative Coghill.
No.
Representative Meyer.
Yes.
Representative Berkowitz.
Yes.
Representative Kukesh.
Yes.
Representative James.
No.
Representative Hogan.
No.
Representative Roper.
Yes.
4-3.
Let's see. House Bill 152 is moved from committee. Next, I'd like to take up House Bill House Bill 40, to revoke driver's license for a fatal accident. Mr. Quinnell, you want to give us the 30-second, turns into a minute, explanation of the, recall our memories from the full hearing we had on this legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Dean Guinelli with the Department of Law. This bill would close a gap in current law, and it would provide that someone who, the driver involved in a fatal accident, who has committed some traffic violation that does not rise to the level of a crime and can't be prosecuted otherwise, would at least have their driver's license taken away for a year, revoked, if the person's driving contributed to a traffic accident in which someone was killed. These traffic accidents occur a handful of times a year. It's when people fall asleep at the wheel, when they are driving too fast for conditions. There are a variety of circumstances when this occurs. But the ultimate impact is someone is dead. There's a grieving family that feels that the law really can take no action, and the law really can't take any action. About the only consequence that occurs is the person is cited with running a red light or crossing the center line or driving off the roadway or something like that. During the hearing we had on this, we heard from a man whose son was killed as a result of someone going too fast for the conditions and crossing the center line and striking a car in which his son was driving. And I think it's unfortunate that those things happen. The law really is powerless to deal with them, and we think that at least a revocation of a license for a year is the appropriate sanction. There's really a very close connection, close nexus, where you've violated a traffic law, you've caused somebody's death, and the license action. So I think it's an appropriate law, and we certainly recommend it.
Any questions, Mr. Manal? Yes.
I don't have any questions. If this is not comment period, then I'll wait.
Sam Coghill and Berkowitz.
Just to ask Mr. Guinelli, isn't this a possibility now with the discretion to the judge?
through the chair, most of the violations where this arises do not carry with it the possibility of a court revocation. And then it has to be something more serious for it to fall under the statutory list of offenses where the court could revoke a license.
Mr. Chair?
Oh, sorry, Representative Bergman.
First section, you're allowing a court to make a finding based on preponderance of an evidence, based on preponderance of evidence. What happens if there are pending civil or criminal litigation at the same time?
Through the chair, I think that first of all, I think this assumes that there is no pending criminal action, because these are ordinarily offenses that kind of fall below that threshold. I mean, there's not a criminally negligent homicide or manslaughter conviction pending. I think it will probably often be the case where there will be civil litigation pending. I think that will happen, and the driver is going to have to choose whether to defend this action or put all their cards into the civil action. I think that's just something that a decision they're going to have to make. You know, getting whatever legal advice they choose to get.
It seemed to me there's a disparity in defending against a traffic action. You're going in front of a magistrate. If you're defending in a civil action, you're going in front of a jury. There ought to be some way of at least deferring the prosecution of the traffic action in light of a potentially much more serious civil action.
Mr. Chairman, I think that there's always a balancing to be done whenever laws are changed, and I think that the interest of the state is getting bad drivers who have caused a fatal accident off the road and not waiting 2 or 3 years for any civil litigation to conclude. And I think people are just going to have to make their choice. I mean, they could conceive that Well, I mean, I think that's just the choice we have to make.
Chairman, is there any danger of this being a lesser included offense in some felony cases?
Through Chair Representative Ogun, I don't believe that that there is that danger, and I think that may have been the problem with prior bills where we tried to work out some sort of civil negligence standards for criminal cases, but I don't think that that would come into play here.
Mr. Guanelli, we received a letter from I believe David Carter Esquire regarding the issue of the rule in the Scott v. Robinson as to civil court cases. It says that the proposed legislation should include language that indicates that any findings made by the court pursuant to the proposed legislation may not be used in evidence in a civil action arising out of the accident. I don't know whether he's an insurance attorney or a defense attorney.
Mr. Chairman, I think that Mr. Carter actually testified by telephone during the hearing, and my recollection from his testimony and having looked at his letter again is, I don't think there's any particular problem with the idea that he proposes. In other words, in fact, that would actually take care of Representative Berkowitz's issue. In other words, leaving the more, perhaps more financially serious consequences to a civil jury, and not having this determination by a magistrate based on preponderance of the evidence be used against someone in a later civil proceeding, I think that's perfectly appropriate, and have no objection to including that.
President Berkowitz, do you want to speak to that?
I would agree, and I hadn't seen this letter before I came, so. If there's a solution to the problem, this would seem fitting.
Or is it a problem? I mean,
based on my experience, this would be a problem. I think.
Yeah, I think Mr. Chairman, I think Mr. Carter's testimony was he was not sure if, in fact, the decision by the magistrate based on a preponderance of the evidence could be used at a later civil trial to establish civil liability. He wasn't sure about that, and I agree with him. I'm not sure that that would be the legal result. But in an abundance of caution, he suggested, well, maybe we ought to make it so that decision by the magistrate, I mean, there might have even been a stipulation. I mean, I think this might be a very quick hearing, that shouldn't be used against someone in any kind of later proceeding. I think that makes sense. I think it would be fairly simple to draft, and perhaps even a conceptual amendment at this point might allow the bill to move on. But I think that
I'll bring up for full disclosure, because the testimony, I did request Mr. Carter's opinion. I'm not sure what the current state of the law is about civil proceedings, but I do have I thought the basic rule of law was you could take a criminal conviction as evidentiary in a civil action to prove negligence and so forth.
That you're correct that is the general rule. The difference here is that this involves a finding that, first of all, based on a preponderance of the evidence, not only that you operated the vehicle, but that there was some causation, that the accident actually contributed to or caused the death of the other person. That's not a finding that is necessary to resolving the traffic citation. I mean, the traffic citation is crossing the center line. The traffic citation is not killing some other person. So this additional finding that really is the justification for taking the license away could potentially be used in a civil action, but because it's not absolutely essential to the criminal violation or the traffic citation, it might not be. I think the court is going to have to look at what were the interests at stake for the individual. Did they have enough at issue in the traffic citation to really put on a full case in that, or did they just sort of blow it off and prefer to wait later for the civil litigation? If they do have an incentive to put on a full full case and litigate this, then I think the court would say, yes, that could be used, that determination by the judge could be used against you later. But I think it kind of depends on how these play out and how exactly the court assesses this. And I think it would just be something that would be subject to litigation. It's probably cleaner to just clear it up, and let's have a provision in here that as Mr. Carter indicates, and I think that would resolve the issue once and for all.
I think I do need to make my statement here now and get Mr. Brunelli to respond to it. I don't know where this bill came from, but I suspect it's from my district. And the reason I say that is because I've had intensive conversation with someone in my district who lost a family member in an accident and was very distressed because the person continued to drive. I don't know all the circumstances of the accident, but I know I searched and talking to this person wanting to do something to fix their problem so they feel better is what the issue is, feel better. And I couldn't find anything that I thought would be applied fairly because it was too loose of a situation is kind of the way I felt. And then the other thing, concern that I had is, you know, there's being in the wrong place at the wrong time or the right place in the wrong time. And even when you're driving on ice, I don't know if there's anyone in this room besides me who have done a 180 in the highway. I have, and I was driving carefully. There was nobody in my way. I hit no one. But someone could have been there, and I could have killed somebody when I did that. So I can tell you, after I did that, I was scared as could be. And is the sin that I did by doing a 180 in the highway on icy roads not a sin if I didn't hit somebody, and if somebody happened to be there and I hit them and they got killed, that was? I couldn't find a comparison between what I had done when I did this and the severity of it. So that bothered me some as well. And then when we're talking about this bill, it sounds, this is where I have a question for you, it sounds like that if you did anything wrong and you hit someone else or caused someone else to be killed in another vehicle, that you're going to lose your license. Well, that doesn't seem like a real severe punishment for this person, but there is the other connection, what if, goes on to that. But on the other hand, in my district particularly, where I have people who have long ways to travel to get to work, it could be a real problem for them not having their license. And so I don't know if there's an ability for them to get a special license to go back to work or that sort of thing. But one of the problems that I have with this whole issue is we're doing this so some people feel better about it. And I don't know that that's the reason that we should be doing all of these kinds of things. So having said all those kinds of things, I'd like to have you respond to that, because I feel real uncomfortable with this piece of legislation and the fact that I really would like to do what these people really want to have done, and yet on the other hand I see that down the road there might be some very unfair and unrealistic circumstances come about. And just one more thing, my father had an accident, this is after I was grown up and married, and he pulled out. He was given a ticket for failure to yield. He had stopped and gone, but the other car that was coming was traveling way, way too fast, and they had this accident, and the one in the rider's seat was killed. You know, he paid a $15 fine for failing to yield. This was in Oregon. That was his penalty. But I can tell you his penalty was deeper than that. I mean, for a long time after that, my father never got over that accident, even though the other driver was going way, way too fast, and his wife was killed in the process. So I suppose those circumstances would have been taken into account in this particular, if this particular law were on the book. But I'm not convinced that taking the driver's license away for a year is really going to solve the other problems that person has. You know, so having said all those kinds of things, I hope that I can lay out there what my real concern about this is and how I'm mixed with emotions to deal with it.
Through the chair, Representative James, I think that this bill came about as a result of complaints that the governor's office received from a number of families of victims who died in those circumstances. And I think that in your district, as well as others, I at the last hearing, Representative Ogun mentioned three constituents or families who've lost children in these circumstances. So I think it really affects a lot of us. I think that there is often, there's a real question. I mean, how much should we do? And on the one hand, you said that maybe taking away the license isn't enough, and on the other hand, I heard you say that maybe in some cases that might be too much. This has a particular provision that allows the court to grant a limited license for the purpose of getting back and forth to work during the entire period of revocation. It's unlike other revocations where for at least some period of time you're without a license at all and you can't even drive to work. This one allows for the entire period of time at least to maintain your livelihood. So I think that, you know, takes care of some of the real extreme examples where someone would need to drive while working. In a way, you're right. I mean, there really is a limit to how much you can do. I mean, for the precise offense that someone commits, driving over the center line or driving too fast for the conditions, I mean, how much do we want to do to that person? And I think what our feeling was that where a judge has made a determination that beyond a reasonable doubt you committed this violation and then makes a further finding that as a result of that somebody died, it's not just a matter of making the victim's family feel better, which I think it also will do, but I think that there is a close enough connection to driving, and whether it's bad driving or bad judgment in exercising when to drive and how fast to drive, I think there's a close enough connection to driving that revoking a license for a period of time is an appropriate sanction.
One quick follow-up on that, because what you said really distressed me is that if the judge found out that there is some error that was made here and that also someone died, it appears to me like the trigger is somebody died, and then what did they do wrong instead of the other way around. Now, if I could be convinced that what their mistake was severe enough and neglectable enough in order to do this, I wouldn't have a problem. But I fear that the other way it's going to go is someone died, then they're going to look seriously at whether or not this was a severe mistake.
Through the chair, the specific wording in the bill is that the judge has to find that the violation of the traffic laws, in other words, the crossing the center line or the falling asleep or the traveling too fast, contributed to the accident. I think that if we said that, you know, that was the sole cause of the accident, then I think that, you know, we'd have a difficult time proving that any person's actions were the only cause of an accident. But I think that the language here contributed to the accident means that you had some role. I mean, you had some contributory role to this accident, and that gives us the connection to driving that justifies the license revocation. We could look at other language, but I think that the judge has to make this finding, and I think that we're going to have to rely on the good faith of the judicial branch to make it in appropriate cases. As I said, we have heard that these kinds of situations arise, you know, a half dozen times a year. We don't expect it to be used more often than that, really. But there's serious cases, and something needs to be done.
Representative Ogun.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. These fingernails have had the dirt. Two of my best friend's kids are being put in a grave under this exact same situation. And I would like, if I could, state their names for the record, if it be on the record, that I'm going to be supporting this bill in the name of Teddy Richardson and Micah Campbell. And the person that violated a traffic law that otherwise wasn't culpable of anything other than violating a traffic law killed two people and got, I think, maximum. I don't want to misquote it, but the sentence was minuscule. Granted, there wasn't any aggravating factors like alcohol or anything else. There's maybe youth and inexperience, but nonetheless, he violated a traffic law. Two people died. So, and was later involved, not was in a car where another person died in an accident. So I think this is imperative to pass. I wish a couple years ago when I brought up this issue, took a different approach to it, that the administration would have worked with me to come up with a workable solution. I think it's a few years too late. I admonish the administration for that. But at least they're coming forth with it. I think it's good legislation. Thanks.
Representative Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't trust my memory. So just like the previous bill, I had written some notes that I was okay with this bill. And I do remember asking Mary the question about when a person gets their license back, do we look at correcting whatever problem they had that removed their license? And I think she said they do. But I would just like to be assured that if somebody makes a judgment in a judgment error, or they cross the line, or they do a circle, as Representative James mentioned, that somehow we work with those folks so they don't just get their license and go back and do it again and potentially kill another person. So could you, hopefully you will remember what Mary's response with the Division of Motor Vehicles was on that.
She's online if you want to direct that.
Is she online?
Mr. Chairman, I am.
Did you hear the question?
I believe so. Mr. Chairman, for the record, Mary Marshburn, Director for the Division of Motor Vehicles. In license, when someone's license is revoked, in order to reinstate the license, they must take the written knowledge test again, which covers, obviously, traffic laws and behavior, as well as paying reinstatement fees and any requirements for the high-risk insurance. In terms of addressing a specific behavior, for instance, what Representative James was talking about, spinning a 180, we don't look at that specific action. No, that's covered, or general behavior, general knowledge is covered in the written test.
Okay. I think that satisfies my question. I would like to see it go a little bit further. I mean, obviously, somebody has a problem behavior in their driving patterns. I'm not sure just taking a written test is going to correct that per se. But then on the other hand, too, I'm not sure you can take each person out and have them prove to you that they will no longer do 180s in the middle of the road. So, thank you, Mary.
Other questions, Mr. Brown? Representative Berkowitz.
I actually have a proposed amendment. On lines 20 and 23, following livelihood, just it would or provide care to another, you know, allowing for the instance where someone might be a care provider and not have earning a livelihood, but care would be necessary.
A conceptual amendment, or are you going to be more precise?
Oh, line 20, following the word livelihood, insert or provide care to another. Use that same phrase at the end of line 23, because we're allowing for an exception for people to get driver's license in order to earn a livelihood, and I also think that not everyone needs to drive just to earn a livelihood. Some people need to drive in order to care for other people.
I'd object to that amendment.
Conceptual amendment number one. There's objection. Discussion. Representative Hogan, you want to...
I just object because it's such I'm sure the counselor knows it's a very ambiguous. I mean, care for someone else. Well, I care for my wife. Or maybe a teenager cares for his girlfriend. What's care for? Emotionally, physically? It's just wide open. I think it's... Lawyers are going to come up with a million reasons why someone cares for someone else, and basically got the bill.
Representative Meyer.
Question for the sponsor of the amendment. Is your intent here that if someone has to take care of a handicapped, disabled person or elderly mother, that they would be able to at least have the ability to drive to take care of them? I think that's your intent.
That's my intent.
And what Representative Hogan is saying is that's still too broad, that it could be interpreted many different ways. Yeah, maybe there's a way to refine this a little bit.
Representative Hogan?
Chairman, don't know if the maker of the amendment would consider a friendly amendment like care for someone that's disabled or something like that. I wouldn't object to it. I think it's humanitarian, but you know, there's they'd have to
narrowing the scope of
disability or disabled or something along those lines.
I'm just pondering to think of what.
Vanilla, do you have any ideas? I see Mr. Ford was in the audience. Representative James.
Well, you know, disabled is a pretty broad term, but, you know, what if you even have to take your kid to the doctor or your mom to the doctor? Or maybe, you know, if someone's having a treatment, they're not necessarily disabled, but they certainly can't drive themselves. It's tough to put it in there. I tend to agree with Representative Berkowitz's concern here that this is pretty light on when they could get a limitation on a driver's license, but I think we need a better term in there.
Just if I can respond to that, I mean, in the event of earning a livelihood, you'd still need to present evidence to the court that you needed to drive in order to earn a livelihood. And I understand Representative Ogun's concerns that people care for one another all the time.
How about long-term caregiver?
Well, dependency of someone else on you, on this person. I think dependency might be.
I'm willing to take assistance with crafting that phrase.
Mr. Guarnelli?
Mr. Chairman, you know, I think I've got the sense of where the committee is going on this one and the other one that was raised by Representative Berkowitz and Mr. Carter. Maybe I could take a stab at drafting up amendments, bring it back before the committee, perhaps next time, and deal with them. I think it's a little difficult to make everybody comfortable with, you know, throwing language back and forth, and unless they see it in writing. So,
it's your bill.
I'd be happy to do that.
Good. Thank you very much.
I will do that.
We'll put the 140 aside and wait for a CS or some amendments. Thank you for the. Input.
Compassion and conservatism at its best, Mr.
Absolutely. I can that. Well, as much as that was going to take 5 minutes, and it took us 50, we shall pick up our testimony on House Bill 4. Note there has been, hopefully if you have distributed, there's now up to Amendment 38, just for everybody's input. I distributed new 36 and 37, and now Representative Berkowitz has added another 38 to the package. We were at amendment number 13 under House Bill 4, and as I indicated, this was the we had discussed whether this was the inhalants issue and how we were going to either have to change the name back to DWI or stick with the DUI and add the word inhalant. Because they're my amendments, I'm not going to offer 13A, which is the DWI reversion. I'm going to offer 13B, which sticks with the DUI, driving while under the influence, change in law, and inserts the inhalant in there as set forth in Amendment 13B. So I'm going to move 13B or the committee's consideration. So, does anybody want to object for discussion? I don't mind.
Object for discussion.
All right. I'm doing this because I, just to refresh everybody's memory, we've had about this issue. I'd like to keep DUI change of definition and nomenclature to, as a example to the public, it's rather what I call didactic or educational to the public that we're changing the law and we're changing the name of the law, and so therefore they should be aware of what the new law is. And also that we're lowering the bar on the 0.8 BAC standard, and I think this more accurately reflects the definition of what we are talking about is driving under the influence and not driving while intoxicated. So that's why I'd prefer to keep the DUI designation. We had a hearing on that. And because of Representative Kapsner's amendment in the Transportation Committee, and the, we're having to clarify the amendment made in the last CS that revolves around that. So I'd prefer to stick with our change. It just cuts down the length of the bill, but I think it's still valid. So, any further discussion on that?
One comment, Mr. Chairman. I think this bill is getting just about like some other bills I had to deal with when I first came here. We almost have to take this bill and slip in the amendments that have already been passed so we know what the bill looks like now.
I know.
It's getting pretty...
That reminds me of the old tort reform bill, but there's a lot of amendments, but this is a lot more...
A lot more likely that the amendment's passing in this
that's
one.
Right, that's right. This is a lot friendly bill. I promise the committee we'll have something we can all read when this thing is done.
I'll hold it to that.
Not necessarily before we move it, but before we vote on it.
Yeah.
So
I don't want you amending it on the floor, Mr. Chairman.
No, I'll make you a promise, and if I to the very best of my ability.
Bring it back to us.
Okay. Chairman promises.
Well. To the best of my ability. You never can tell about a little technical correction.
I understand that.
Amend.
Been there, done that.
I would like the majority leader to take due note that I have not issued one floor amendment this year.
Yet.
Mr. Gwinnell.
I don't know whether might help. I testified before that the title of the bill, what we call it, has really no legal effect. After a while, if it starts getting a little too long, it affects the readability of any statute. And I mean, one thing you may want to just consider is just calling the crime driving while under the influence, and then defining influence or under the influence to mean under the influence of alcoholic beverages, inhalants, or controlled substances.
Mr. Ford, we tried that.
That's been tried.
Yeah. Well, we appreciate that, but we endeavored to do that also. Mr. Ford, can
you explain? That's exactly what the bill does.
Well,
Mr. Chairman, I was trying to restrain myself, but but I can't. So let me just make one comment, if I can. This is a law which, if you look at it, has some peculiarities. My name is Mike Ford. I'm with the Division of Legal Services. AS 2835030 is operating a vehicle, aircraft, or watercraft while intoxicated. But it also includes controlled substances. Now, is that intoxication? I don't know. But if you look at the progression of the law, what we've done here is we've started out with intoxication, and we've added things to the law. And I think the inhalant question is one example of that, where we have changed the law to match what we think is our current thinking. And I think what Mr. Guinelli is suggesting, in an effort to shorten it up, is perhaps a thought that could be pursued. And I had another suggestion, which was, what's wrong with driving while impaired? Because that's really what we're talking about here. We're talking about someone whose driving ability is impaired.
Mr. Ford, we have an impairment statute already. Then we'd have to change that. And that would really start muddying the waters as far as the officer out in the street that has to make this thing work.
Well, and on top of that is sleeping impaired.
Well, that's another bill coming next year. Right.
Well, Mr. Chairman, no, my point is simply you could define it to be a number of things. It
right.
could be intoxicated, it could be controlled substances, it could be inhalants, but for purposes of the rest of the statutes, driving while impaired in violation of would be fairly simple and easy to understand. I think that's the concept the committee's talking about. It's not simply under the influence of what?
Mr. Ford, I was under the impression from our conversations that, albeit it was brief, that you felt constrained to draft anything that was encompassing. Because of the inhalant and the controlled substance and alcohol element and all these various different things.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the options you have now on the table are to go back to intoxicated and simply amend 030 in a manner that includes inhalants.
Right.
That's one option. The other option is to add inhalants to the list of things and change it to being under the influence of A, B, C, or D.
Right.
And what I'm suggesting is a third option, which is driving while impaired, forget A, B, C, and D, except under 030.
Well, how about under the influence under 030?
Well, but influence what? It's not influence, it's impairment, I'm saying, suggesting is the issue.
Then we'd have to change the impairment statutes.
What impairment statutes are you referring to?
we've lowered it to 04, and we have impairment statutes doing that.
Well, if you're talking about driving under the influence of intoxicating liquor, that's 030. I'm just suggesting this would be a way to also look to the future. Next year, there may be some other item that you think also should be prohibited from taking and driving. And you could just add to your list as long as you like.
Well, isn't it true that we can have impairment under existing statutes if they're at 0.04 or 0.05?
That's an example of an impairment. Exactly.
I understand.
We do have an impairment statute, and it's at 0.05. As a matter of fact, that's how many of the arrests I know in Anchorage, they actually make the arrest under the impairment statute.
Might I follow up on that? The only reason for going to 0.08 is that gives them another hammer in the determination of the guilt, as opposed to stopping them because they were driving erratic.
Per se impairment, though. It sets the per se level of under the influence or drunk.
They don't have to then really participate so much in the impairment part of it. It's only the part. Yeah, you're here, so yes, you were. So, you know, that is a little different.
Can you come up with another catch-all word besides impairment, though? Maybe I might buy into your suggestion.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think isn't that the essence of what we're talking about, though? I mean, if you were, like I said, we start out with intoxicated. Everyone thinks that's bad.
No, unless you're a prohibitionist. Then you think impairment's 0.01.
Well, that's one example of impairment. Under 030, as it reads now, you do not have to pass that threshold to be convicted of this offense. You can be convicted simply by being under the influence of intoxicating liquor, whether you reach 0.10 or not.
That's right.
So that's only one example of impairment. And I'm suggesting that if you go to an impairment standard, you could have a number of examples. Whereas under the influence really just begs the question, influence of what? Is it inhalants? Is it controlled substances? Is it alcohol? Cell phones? Your date? Whatever.
It certainly is.
I get it.
Could be a number of things. And I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, to spring this on you like this, but
it certainly is all
I think what you're doing at this point raises exactly this question. And I hesitated to make the suggestion because I know a lot of work has gone into the two options you have. This will not make your bill any shorter, but I think it would make it better in the long sense.
Representative Berger.
Having actually prosecuted and defended using these terms, I would respectfully disagree. Because semantically what you're saying, well, if you're driving while impaired, the defense essentially is going to be, yes, I had some, but I was not impaired. If you talk about driving while under the influence, it's not as easy a threshold to convey to a jury. And what we're talking about here is not people who, I mean, impairment is more of a subjective subjective determination. Influence, people can be influenced without being impaired, and I think that's what we're trying to get at.
Well, I think the other way around, too. I mean, to me, impairment is symptomatic or is a synonym for tipsy or not quite intoxicated or under the influence. So I mean, and then we have this whole variant of gradations of how inebriated you are by your blood alcohol content, your weight, other characteristics. So,
Mr. Chairman, what I'm suggesting is that's exactly what you'd use, the same things. It's driving while impaired from intoxicating liquor, controlled substance. You would still have your threshold or per se offense, and you could add inhalants or any number of things to specify that those things also trigger the standard.
Well, I agree with Representative Berkowitz. I'm in trouble by making this. At this hour.
I agree.
Maybe we can discuss it further, Mr. Ford. I'd be happy to discuss that. And because I think there would be a confusion, particularly in the law enforcement community, when we redefine what impaired is. We're going all the way from intoxicated down to impaired. And then then what do we do with the less than 0.08 standard then?
And just let me also respond a little bit to what Representative James said. I mean, the reality is if someone comes in under a 0.10 currently and they come in under a 0.08, even if there's bad driving, it's essentially almost a guaranteed acquittal because jurors look at that as a break point. I mean, when you charge dually, you charge
as being over and also for being impaired. If you're under, juries will let you walk almost every time.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to be clear about one thing. I'm not proposing a change in the standard as much as I'm proposing a change in the description of the standard.
Well, the nomenclature, and I think that's problematic from current practice now. We're going to make enough changes. As complex as this bill is, my personal philosophy is a KISS to keep it as simple as possible. So I just think that aggravates it unless we can condense a lot of stuff by the economy of language, which would be the intoxication standard if we wanted to retain that. So I mean, it's worth enough to chop down a couple more trees to publish statute books, then so we change the name so people get the point.
I'm planting more trees anyway.
Good. We'll get the excellent. I appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Ford. Is Amari going to maintain your objection to 13B?
No, I was only objecting for discussion purposes.
Thank you, sir.
Coming right along.
We'll adopt 13B. Thank you. Next, we have Jan. Let's get to it here. Mr. Ford, you want to,
Place.
I'd move 14B and ask that we have an explanation from Ms. Seitz or Ms. Ford. 14B? I'm sorry. Amendment number 14, I move.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Janet Seitz, Representative Ropeworks Office. Amendment number 14 provides the Department of Public Safety with some options to dispose of forfeited property when they've come into possession of a vehicle under the forfeiture statutes in House Bill 4.
And takes out a couple of Are we deleting a couple of sections there, Janet?
Just renumbering.
Yeah, we're just renumbering, Mr. Chairman.
Renumbering. I'm sorry. Okay. Any questions about Amendment number 14? Representative Berkowitz.
So trooper sees a vehicle, and then they sell it at auction?
They could, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Are there any existing state agencies that dispose of property?
Mr. Chairman, my personal recollection is that the Department of Administration has a surplus section. State office equipment and...
My concern is that we're tasking DPS with doing something that not currently set up to do, and there is another state department that has the ability to do that.
Mr. Chairman, I believe to the chairman, this amendment is to give the Department of Public Safety a little more latitude, rather than, for example, having if they have a vehicle in a rural area rather than having to move it into someplace and then declare it surplus and transfer it there. It does allow under subsection 3 that they can declare it surplus and transfer it to the Department of Administration, which could then go through their surplusing process. But it also gives them the option of selling it or transferring it to a state or municipal law enforcement agency or destroying it if there's not a way to economically get it from one point to another.
Earthen James?
Well, Mr. Chairman, according to the way the statute currently reads, appears to me they already have that, because it says discretion of the Department of Public Safety. But are there some regulations separate from this that indicates that these things are not already available? Are we establishing something that is not in their decision-making process? Because if we just take the words out that you're adding in here, it says they must maybe dispose of at the discretion of the Department of Public Safety. Certainly that gives them, it says, and then it even says, that now with your new added language, the disposal under the subsection includes by way of example and not of limitation. So the whole carte blanche authority of what to do with disposing of this is still at the discretion of the Department of Public Safety. My concern is, why do we put this in there at all unless there's a regulation you'd like to change? And I don't know if that's the case or not.
I'm not sure. Is Lieutenant Dungan online? I'm not sure he is today.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am.
Oh, very good, sir. Mr. Dungan, did you hear Representative James? Do you have... I thought this amendment arrived out of a discussion we had with you regarding suggestions of flexibility as to disposition and disposal. Are there any existing regulations that that you have in your department for this type of disposal?
None that I'm aware of, Mr. Chairman. If we had a car or a vehicle that we would not give to a government agency or take for use amongst ourselves, then what we would do would be to turn that over to DOT. It would go through the sale by the Department of Administration, and then the Department of Administration would charge DPS 5% sale for handling that sale. That's how it would currently be done. I think the discussion that you're talking about, sir, was when I was working with the fiscal note trying to get it as reasonable as possible. We had decided that since we had discretionary powers under the statute to dispose of vehicles as we saw fit, what our preference would be in rural areas would be to give those vehicles to like CPSO or a city government in villages so that they could use that for their purposes, and that would reduce the amount of cost that DPS had to put out for shipping and storage of impounded vehicles from the outlying area.
Yeah, I think the committee agreed with you for the record that you should have that flexibility. I think Ms. Seitz is going to speak to the amendment.
Mr. Chairman, in discussions with the legislative liaison for the Department of Public Safety, and I don't believe he's here, but the intent here was they felt more comfortable with something in statute rather than just the general may be disposed of at the discretion. And they wanted, this was developed with their cooperation, and they wanted some specific language that gave them more ability, especially like to transfer to a state or municipal law enforcement agency.
What happened to the charitable organization?
Mr. Chairman, there was a conclusion on our part that as state property, you could not simply give it away. If that's your reference to giving the vehicle to a charity.
Well, I guess I have a problem with that, because sometimes disposing of property is more expensive than the value of it. So I don't know why that, even under disposed at the discretion of the Department of Public Safety, why they wouldn't be supported if they let someone have it because there was no value to sell it. I mean, if that's the case, then I think we need to make that in statute of that they are allowed to dispose of it in the most economically and viable way or whatever. And I agree that if they wanted to leave some of these vehicles out in the rural area because it's so expensive to bring it in, that's certainly a good argument for that. The way this is listed, and then it says that these are just by example and not by limitation. When we start listing things down, then it seems to me like people like to stick with the listing. And I don't know what all of the options might be out there, and I don't want to exclude any. So when we make this list, there may be something come up that doesn't fit one of these, and I'll bet you anything they don't do it. That's my concern, and I guess we have to trust the folks that are doing this, and maybe some people don't, but I have a lot of faith in the Department of Public Safety, except when they destroy guns. I would think that...
always an exception, isn't there?
There's always an exception, that's exactly right. And in that particular case, they destroyed valuable, could have been sold for money. In any event, having a list that's not conclusive is problematic to me. And it's definitely not conclusive, but it's suggestive. And if they need authority to not necessarily sell the property, I think we could do that. I just am not comfortable listing these things here.
Well, it says they may, currently they can dispose of it at their discretion. So, I mean, I take your argument. I think that we were reacting to the administration's request for more clear guidance, is all. And the fact that there apparently are no current regulations on disposal.
Well, we could say they should write regulations if they want to be consistent.
No, but I'm sure they can already.
And I think when you do this, they will.
Mr. Chairman, this is Lieutenant Dunnigan.
Yes, sir. Could you comment, but please speak up a little bit, Lieutenant, if you would.
Yes. Can you hear me now?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Representative James brings up a good point when she makes reference to the gun. And Mr. Guinelli may be able to answer that another question about this particular section. He and I had an earlier discussion, and there was some discussion as to whether or not we were just free to destroy something like that, because even a scrap metal, a car, has some value. So you may want to ask him about that as far as the legal aspect.
Thank you, sir. Danny threw you the ball. Bring a chair in. Musical chair. Oh.
Mr. Chairman, I think I was one of the ones who initially asked for some additional statutory guidance beyond the very general, you can do something at your discretion. And the reason why I thought some additional guidance was needed was because of the firearms issue that Representative James referenced, where we actually got sued for destroying firearms. Department of Public Safety didn't want to spend the money to determine whether or not they were safe, and didn't want them being put back in circulation and destroyed them. And we ended up getting sued, and the legislature ended up passing a statute that told the department exactly what to do with that kind of property. So before we could, in my view, before we could simply give it away to a charity, for example, I felt a lot more comfortable if we had a specific reference in a statute that said that that's one of the things that you can do. I mean, obviously there's a legislature's appropriation authority that comes into play, and I think that that a list like this is appropriate. But if, with the one caveat, if you do want to include giving away to charities or nonprofit entities, however it may be worded, I think it should probably be set out in here. I'm a little bit nervous about advising the Department of Public Safety to simply give away property to other than to a government agency, because we might get sued again.
Mr. Chairman, if I might respond to that, because certainly there's a process for discretion from my practical experience that I've had, and that when you do make a decision to do something, you substantiate your reasons for doing that. Finding a fact, as an example, which is setting a case to whether or not anybody can sue you for it or not. I mean, in my experience, even in the local government, any decision we made out at the planning board or the planning authority, we had to put down why we made this decision, establish the reasons, and if they're good enough and no one can sue us for it, we don't get sued. If they're not good enough, we get sued. And I don't think this prohibits that from happening, even under this. It allows you to do those things, but it doesn't say what your net obligation is. And I can better bet you that if you gave away something that was really valuable for no money, you're going to have somebody come after you anyway, unless you list down in finding the facts why you made that decision and had a rational way.
Through the chair, I understand that. I understand that position, and it's a reasonable one. However, I think that I'm not certain what kind of findings the state could make to justify simply giving away a valuable car to one charity as opposed to another charity. I think if that authority is going to be exercised, I would like to see it set out in statute that we can do that. Because otherwise, it would probably be my advice to the Department of Public Safety that it's safer overall to just sell it at auction. And then the proceeds get deposited in the general fund, and legislature, you know, can use that money. I think it'd be expecting a lot of Department of Public Safety to try to come up with findings of fact as to why they wanted to transfer a particular car to a particular charity and not to another. So I'm a little bit nervous about that. And that's in any event. And I do agree with the question of being destroyed. I mean, I think that when you're going to destroy something, then I think you really do have to make some kind of showing that it's not worth very much money. The cost of selling it would be more than the cost you're going to get from it, and so we destroy it. I mean, I think their findings of fact make sense. I think, you know, giving it away, I think it becomes more problematical.
Well, on that point, and I don't mean to belabor this issue, it's just that if I were a Department of Public Safety official, and I had this piece of something out there, and I gave it to a charity, I don't care which charity it was, I could certainly write down why I did that and why I didn't give it to another one. There's got to be a reason. You just don't do it because somebody says, give it to me, and you say, okay. I mean, you know why you did that, and that's what I'm not thinking about. You know, real complicated things. I'm just thinking about this was a decision. They were in great need. We had this vehicle. If we were sold it, we wouldn't probably, there was a cost of getting it sold. I mean, there's all different kinds of things that could have been done. And so I just don't think see that fear of that. But it is problematic if we were to put give to a charity down here because it is a little different than these other things. And it is suggestive when there's so many charities out there, so maybe we ought not to put that in here. Anyway, this just bothers me.
Do you have it figured out yet, Jim?
Yeah, I'd take it all out if it was me and leave it like it was. But
what about the charities and the destruction, though?
Well, I think at the discretion of the public safety, it still covers that.
Any other comments on this?
Mr. Chairman, the state disposes the property to charities. Now, times if nobody else wants it.
I'd hope so.
I mean, walk to the warehouse and say, I want that, that, and that, and that. If you're a nonprofit, I'll give it to you. Nobody else wants it.
Well, we're just trying to be accommodative of the administration on this
amendment. I'm not going to vote to amend to destroy this amendment. I just wanted to be sure that all my points were made on the record. It's convinced that sometime in the future it comes back to haunt us.
Well, I appreciate that, and I am concerned that department doesn't feel strongly enough about the their discretionary grant and are fearful enough in the legislature that they want to have statutory language to it. Maybe I'm reading too much into that.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Cox,
one of the questions that didn't get answered was if there was anything in regulation that this was addressing.
I think it was answered in the negative. They don't have regulation.
All right, thank you. And then the other thing is the Mr. aircraft Ford. And watercraft were also put in this. And
that's another, yeah. I think it's another part of the bill. Mr. Ford, you said that we couldn't put charity organizations in here?
Well, Mr. Chairman, this is the concern in our office. Once the vehicle is forfeited, it's property of the state. And property of the state cannot simply be given away.
Why not?
Because we have a constitution that says you don't give away things unless you appropriate them.
Constitutional flag going
off. That's why the options of surplus or destruction, transfer to another agency, those all fit. But just simply giving it away doesn't seem to fit.
Well, shoot.
But then we still have to appropriate it to the legislature. Is that what you're saying?
Correct.
Like, it's one of my druthers was to give the particularly Department of Public Safety more comfort in this issue because they were had enough problem with the forfeiture elements as it was. So,
well, it seems to me like, Mr. Chairman, if I might respond to that, and I suppose they are required to take something in, but if I had a choice and it was something that was going to cost me more money than it was worth, I wouldn't take it in the first place.
Well, I think the Department of Public Safety has a responsibility, and we've talked a little time done again about this, is what they do with, like, the vehicle that was destroyed almost entirely. And they have to pick it up, basically impound that, you know, highly damaged vehicle, which is going to be a pretty common occurrence. You know. It has little or no residual value in the marketplace. Ergo, then they have to dispose of it. So.
Very difficult for me to believe that you can't give away something with negative value without it being an appropriation. I can see us appropriating it now. We're going to give this car to XYZ charity, and it's bigger than, I mean, we're taking away a liability.
I agree. And Representative Ogden said you were aware of it, perhaps, that they had given away property to charities before? Or?
Yes, sir, to my best of my knowledge, or both to nonprofits, because I've, as a chief of nonprofit fire department, obtained property from the state that was available. I think all their, if memory serves me, it's been a number of years, but I don't know the procedure, but I would assume that it was available because nobody else wanted it. And they said, yeah, you want this? Cheers. We got it. Got some hoses.
Part of the municipal government, though, the volunteer?
No, it's not. It's a nonprofit
corporation.
There's a, I mean, to the best of my knowledge, there's a hierarchy of claim on
right.
property.
Right.
And there's a difference between giving it to a volunteer fire department, which is, as I recall, is somewhere down in the hierarchy of claim. I mean, they go to local government first, and then subdivisions and school districts. And I don't,
we were on the bottom of the hierarchy because we weren't a governmental.
Right, but that's firm. But it's not the same as giving it to a charity. There's authorization exists for, I would presume, the fire department. I don't know specifically, but for the fire department to make a claim, they just have to wait for the municipalities and maybe the other state agencies to go first. And that's not the same as, say, I mean, you think of a charity, for example, your favorite charity, the Sierra Club, and
everyone I like to shoot at.
I can ask Mr. Ford a question.
President James.
If the department was wanting to, they had something that really, the cost of selling it would be excessive, and it was something that a charity wanted, couldn't they pay them something for it? Small amount?
I think if they go through the disposal process, sure.
Okay. That's the answer to that.
So, well, all things considered, and I think we have a sound public record on this issue, I'd prefer to keep the amendment in. Was there objections to the amendment? You objected?
I removed my objection. I didn't say, still don't like it, but I'll accept.
Perhaps we'll keep this on our tune-up list as it moves along. How do we put that on your tune-up list? And the objections are removed on amendment number 14. Amendment number 14 is adopted. I move amendment number 15, Ms. Seitz.
Mr. Chairman, amendment number 15 changes your diversionary program for the 0.08 to less than 0.1. It also lengthens the time that the court has to advise the Division of Motor Vehicles of a conviction from the end of the following business day to within 5 working days. Under this amendment, your diversion program now includes a person serving 72 consecutive hours of imprisonment, successfully completing a 1-year period of probation during which they cannot commit any alcohol or traffic-related offenses, paying the cost of treatment, performing 24 hours of community service, paying the fines imposed by the court.
And therefore, what we're doing is we've almost completely got rid of the diversion program except for the suspended imposition.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Which has the advantage, in my opinion, of offering to the first offender who keeps his nose clean and didn't exceed the 0.1 standard that they would have a chance to keep that off their record. But if, in fact, they reoccurred and reoffended the second time, the state would count their first offense.
That's correct.
As a prior. So, Representative Berkowitz.
I still object to it. And one of the other differences that I just see on a cursory read is you're deleting the first sentence where you talk about no aggravating circumstances associated with the acts upon which the conviction is based. So, conceivably, someone who did have aggravating circumstances could be eligible for the suspended imposition.
No, it's not. I don't think that was the intention.
That's what the amendment does.
That's what the amendment does.
Does it?
Yes, sir. No, there's no element of aggravating circumstances in the change.
I thought that if there... Oh, excuse me. I just glanced over that.
In other words,
if there is an aggravator, I thought if there were an aggravator, they wouldn't be eligible for the diversion.
That's not correct, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, it isn't.
Under this language, as you're proposing, it's simply, are you within the parameters, 0.08 to 0.099, then you're eligible.
Okay. I see.
And Mr. Chair, I also, there's a real problem. I mean, just thinking of the courtroom scenario with trying to set up a 0.08 to 0.10 window. You'll hear a lot of times people argue about rising or falling BAs at the time they took the test. You know, was their blood alcohol going up or was it going down when they took the test? And when you draw a window this narrowly and essentially attach a real high premium to it, less jail time, less...
We've reimposed all that.
But there's less sanction imposed. If you fall into this window.
There's absolutely no less sanction except for the
suspended imposition.
Suspended imposition.
Right. That's less sanction.
Oh, I agree.
And I mean, because at the end of a suspended imposition of sentence, if someone successfully completes it, they can say, no, I was never convicted.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. But if philosophically, if we're lowering the BA from 0.10 to 0.08, we're lowering it. We oughtn't be creating a window. But if we are creating a window, it's a complete invitation to litigation. You're going to see every low-range BA litigated heavily in the courtroom because people are going to come in and say, my 0.11, yeah, but I was rising. I was a rising 0.11. When the cops pulled me over, I was a 0.08. That becomes a real significant issue. Once that happens, then costs increase because there's more court time, there's more law enforcement time, there's more prosecutor time, there's more expert testimony time, there's more defense time. It adds up significantly, and I think this is a huge cost on the system. And
I think, well, according to the fiscal notes, there's only about a $28,000 increase or something like that. Is that right?
And the fiscal note is from which agency?
Multiple agencies. Corrections. Because what we're doing here, Representative Berkowitz, is putting the jail time back in with his amendment.
Right. So
you shouldn't.
I'll track my fiscal note on this particular amendment, on this particular section. But if you ask any line prosecutor or any line defense attorney, they will tell you this is a complete invitation for more court time. And there's just no way around it. You're going to litigate every single incident, probably between, and I'm just guessing, 0.08 all the way up to 0.13. And that gets to be a good chunk of the DWIs because people are going to come in and say, you convicted me, but I was a rising BA at the time. You're going to get in, if you recall the Exxon Valdez, there was all that discussion of how long after the incident they tested. That becomes hugely significant when you're trying to make a determination about BA.
Then, if let's just say the window isn't there, don't we still have that same problem?
No, because if you're over 0.08, you're over 0.08. It's the same way now. If you're over 0.10, sure, the group up to 0.10.
Wouldn't the discussion then be when did they give the test?
Well, it's when they gave the test. There's also case law out there that says that the intoximeter is an instrument, and there are tolerances within that instrument, and there's case law which says the tolerance, you have to have, up to a .01 difference. So, you know, someone could come in at a .011 and say, no, I'm really at a .10. You have to factor everything in the defendant's, in favor of the defendant. So you've got two things working on this system. You've got error tolerances within the instrument. You've got the rate of alcohol absorption of the individual. You've got the timing of the test. It becomes hugely significant.
Mr. Chairman, I have a
question on this issue. Isn't it true that even if you're just a 0.10, that becomes a valid argument, or has been a valid argument?
Right. And I would bet if you go and look at every .10 that's been charged, it's not charged as a, or not every, but they're usually not charged as a DWI or they're pled out to a reckless driving, because the defense will come in and say, look, it's a .10 on the intoximeter, but because you have to give you have to give doubt on the defendant's side, it's going to read at a .09 because you got that 1/100th of a error mechanism. So they're gone then. I mean, they're out of the statutory range right away.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I might follow up then, a .08 is going to have that same kind of condition. If we just go down to .08, we have that same kind of condition. But having said that, mm-hmm. if you have a different set of circumstances for the .08 to the .10, mm-hmm. Then you've got both of those issues that are going to be at issue, which I would agree is going to increase the court issue. However, we've been given a very small number of folks that fall in that, so I don't know what the 28,000, is that what was estimated?
No, it's really the 72 hours or 3 days of jail time. There's only, was it $28,000 difference between the diversion, with or without the diversion program?
Approximately 28,000.
So we're raising the fiscal note here by putting the jail time back in.
How many cases was that?
Well, that's based on the 10% plug number, which this committee and myself believe is incorrect from the figures of the Department of Public Safety. I think it's 5%.
So, but even 5%, how many cases are we talking about?
What was that?
Department of Corrections used 413 misdemeanors.
In that range?
In that 10% range.
Okay, so say there's 200 cases a year that fall into this range. And that's one a day. That's one motion a day that we're dealing on. Some of these motions will go for, Dean Bonelli can tell you, these motions can go for as long as the trial almost.
Yeah, this is a two-tiered system against the .08 standard. Mr. Guinelli, you want to comment? We're actually having a debate on the whole diversion program, which includes about half the amendments.
That's what I was going to say. I think this is key to the diversion
yeah.
program.
Right. Mr. Chairman, we really have a strong objection to this amendment. And the objection really is that an
you don't want the jail time, or you just don't like diversion? What?
An SIS, a suspended imposition of sentence, where someone gets a drunk driving conviction taken off their record and is again treated as a first offender even when they get their next offense, we think that that's inappropriate. In adopting .08 as the legal standard, the legislature is making a policy decision based on a lot of good data that people at .08 level are under the influence and shouldn't be driving. I mean, I think that we've seen tests, we may have gone through tests where your reaction time more than doubles at .08. And for that reason, these offenders really ought to be treated the same as other offenders at least in terms of the sentence that is imposed, at least in terms of identifying them as a drunk driver, and if they come back again and do it again, identifying them as a second, or if they come back again, identifying them as a third. I just don't see any justification for in all cases, you know, giving people that kind of break to basically, you know, wipe their record clean. And you know, for that reason, we object to it. I mean, I do believe that Representative Berkowitz makes some good points about it raises the stakes and it's going to make the trials more difficult. I think that we may very well have to have, you know, a special verdict by the jury to determine whether it was under .10. All of those things can be taken into account, and we can deal with those at the trial level. But I think it raises some aspects of unfairness where people are charged with drunk driving, but let's say the intoximeter machine isn't working. They don't have an opportunity to blow into the machine and prove that they were under .11. What's going to happen with those offenders? They're going to say, gosh, if
a blood test under this gun?
Well, I suppose they could demand a blood test, but I just don't see any justification for wiping the record clean. Part of this whole bill was to identify problem drivers, drunken drivers, at an early stage by adopting .08, expanding the look-back provision for third offenders to identify those people. And I think that you circumvent all of that if you allow people to wipe the slate clean. And that's the reason we object to that.
Mr. Chairman, may I make a point?
Mr. Ford.
Well, it's still a prior conviction for purposes of 030.
Yeah.
Is that what you're referring to?
No, it's not.
Oh.
It's not. If it's a suspended imposition of sentence, it goes away.
No, it is a prior conviction under this language. Prior conviction includes a conviction that you received SIS for.
That's, we made provision for that, Mr. Ford?
Correct. If you get a subsequent conviction and you fall into this diversion program, you've committed a second offense for purposes of 030.
Mr. Chairman, I saw that provision. It creates a huge ambiguity because the SIS statute says you get it taken off your record. On the other hand, this other thing says it doesn't come off your record. Now, what's the court going to do when it weighs those two and says there's this ambiguity? All ambiguities in criminal statutes are resolved in favor of the defendant. And so as it is drafted now, it's going to come off that person's record. If it doesn't come off their record, then it's not an SIS. Then it's not a suspended imposition of sentence, because that is the effect of a suspended imposition of sentence. It comes off your record. So, you know, we either do it or we don't do it. We can't say we're giving them an SIS, but then don't give them the legal effect of an SIS. It doesn't make any sense.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't agree with that. I think the legislature could certainly craft a provision that provides different treatment, and done it in this case. If they want to provide that there are consequences for a subsequent conviction, but in fact you are allowed to receive certain benefits if you fall within a certain class, it can do so.
Mr. James.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to ask this question. If, you know, in going to point 08, is it the position of the legislature, or intended to be the position of the legislature, that we're not going to just move from point 1 to point 08 as determining where the impairment is really severe and identify it as intoxication? Or are we wanting to phase in and take this one little group of people from point 08 to point 1 and treat them differently? Because to me, if we're going to just move the ladder down, we ought to just leave it the same as it was currently. So somebody's got to give me the rationale for sort of doing it, but not totally doing it.
Well, right. This comes apart from my drafting and the recommendations of some people, is that there was a belief that the enactment of a diversion program in the .08 would improve the chances of passage of the .08 standard. And by crafting the diversion to a very narrow group, and